Welcome to the last reading of this year's series. I hope all of you can come to the terrace room at the Student Union to meet Mr. Logan following the reading. I can't bear not to have at least one announcement. So I would like to remind you that the Poetry Center collection is not a circulating collection. So if any of the books made their way to your house, would you bring them back? Just stick them in the mailbox and we won't look. John Logan has come to us from Hawaii. He will be soon returning to Buffalo, where he is poet in residence. His most recent publication is Poem in Progress, published by the Dryad Press, which he will be reading for us tonight. I'd like to read a quote from James Dickey. One closes Logan's books thinking, yes, this is what poetry can sometimes do. This is what poetry can sometimes be. And I know you'll enjoy hearing John Logan's poetry.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Shelton. I'm delighted that I was invited here. I've not been to Tucson before. I've spent some time in Albuquerque, but I think I've only flown through here, and it's sort of a very pleasant experience to spend some time here. I'm going to divide the reading into two parts with a brief intermission in between. Lois mentioned that I just published a book called Poem in Progress. It's a book-length poem. When I say book length, I don't mean the size of Cummings' collected poems or anything like that. It's in 8 sections, and it'll take me a little over half an hour to read. In the first part of the reading, I'm going to read a couple of poems I was asked to do, and then get into newer things. You constantly feel somewhat more in touch, I think, with the work which is closer, and so that's what I would like to do, is to share more recent things. But first I want to read an older poem from The Spring of the Thief, which I talked about in one of Steve Orland's classes today, and which I was asked to read tonight by Doug Canfield. It's called On Reading Camus in Early March. There's an epigraph to the poem from Camus' writing. I discovered inside myself, even in the very midst of winter, an invincible summer. That boy in the red coat packing snow mixes in my mind with the obscure taste for beauty Camus' writing stirs. I don't say the beauty of the boy, open only through his naked face, only his eyes drawing the full stores of his emerging life that seem to root deeply back toward the dead. See how the boy stands footless in the snow, like some smashed piece of Italian stone. Not that, but what he does to the cold, pure seed or sand through his muffled hand. How he brings the Midas touch of art. I don't care how crude he seems to mold. Not sad or old, not adult, the boy has no more need of art than a saint. And he throws against the wall, shattering what his hand could form, as I feel the older, more yearning child's alarm. Then I have a poem called 54 or 5 Towns, which I talked about in a couple of classes, but I have not read, and I was asked to read it. and I'm glad to do that. Should mention to you that the poem talks about William Carlos Williams, a visit to William Carlos Williams, who lived in Rutherford, New York, who since has died. And it also speaks about Paul Blackburn, who has also since died, though he was much younger than Williams, but he died of cancer about 3 years ago. I dedicated this poem to James Wright, whom at the time I wrote it I had never met. And he was in the hospital, badly off. I sent it to him because we had corresponded, and he said that he liked it very much, so I gave it to him. You'll find the poem dated, a reference to the Capital Viscount Airlines at the end would be one way of dating it. That airline has, for a long time, merged with various others. I don't know where its trace finally ended up. But also, Williams was alive when I had visited him and wrote the poem. Before he died, he was working on his posthumous book, The Poems by Bruegel, a poem based on paintings by Bruegel. He had had a stroke and wasn't able to read them, had never heard them. So we read them to him for the first time. But I changed that in the poem. One of the great things about being a poet is that you don't have to tell it the way it is. Instead, you tell it the way it is. The gold-colored skin of my Lebanese friends, their deep, lightless eyes, the serene, inner, careful balance they share, the conjugal smile of either for either. This belly-chilling, shoe-soaking, factory-dug-up, hill-smothering Pittsburgh weather. I wait for a cab in the smart mahogany lobby of the seminary. The marble pietà is flanked around with fake fern. She cherishes her dead son. Stretched along her womb, he triple-crossed. A small, slippered priest pads up. Whom do you seek, my son? Father, I've come in out of the rain. I seek refuge from the elemental tears, for my heavy earthen body runs to grief. And I am apt to drown in this small and underhanded rain that drops its dross so delicately on the hairs of the flowers of my father and follows down the veins of leaves weeping quiet in the wood. My yellow cab never came, but I did not confess beneath the painted Jesus Christ. I left and never saved myself at all that night in that late winter rain. In Washington, was it spring? I took the plane. I heard on either side the soft executives, manicured and fat, fucking this and fucking that. My heavy second breakfast lay across my lap. At port in the great concourse, I could not walk to city bus or cab or limousine. I sweat with shock, with havoc of the hundred kinds of time, trembling like a man away from home. At the National Strip Show, where the girls wriggle right and slow, I find I want to see in under the sequin step-in. And in my later dream of the Negro girl's room, strong with ancient sweat and with her thick aroma, I seem to play a melodrama as her great red dog barks twice and I stab it with my pocket knife. In Richmond, the azalea banks burst in rose and purple gullies by the car, muted in the soft, wet April twilight. The old estates were pruned and rolled fresh with spring, with splendor, touching the graceful stride of the boy who brings the paper. My friend has a red-headed mother, capable of love in any kind of weather. I am not sure what she passes to her daughters, but from her brown eye and from her breast, she passes wit and spunk to her big sons. And she is small and pleased when they put their arms around her, having caught her. They cut the grass naked to the waist. They cure the handsome skins of chipmunks and of snakes. And when they wake in their attic room, they climb down the ladder, half asleep, feeling the rung's pressure in their bare feet. Shirt tails out, brown eyes shut. They eat what she cooks. One shot a gorgeous colored hawk and posed with it, proud, arms and full wings spread. And one at the beach, balanced on his hands, posed stripped in the void of sand, limbs a rudder in the wind amid the lonely, blasted wood. And two sons run swift roams in the high summer grass. Now, I would guess her daughters had at least the same grace and beauty as their mother, though I have only seen their picture. I know she is happy with her three strong sons about her, for they are not clumsy, one calm, so calmly bends a good ear to his guitar, and they are not dull, one built a small electric shaft topped with a glowing ball. In New York, I got drunk, to tell the truth, and almost got locked up when a beat friend with me took a leak in a telephone booth. E.E. Cummings on the Paris lawn, Revier le pisseur américain. At 2 o'clock, he got knocked out, horning in with the girl in the room over him. Her boyfriend was still sober and too thin. I saw the blood of a poet flow on the sidewalk. Oh, if I mock, it is without heart. I thought of the torn limbs of Orpheus scattered in the grass on the hills of Thrace. Do poets have to have such trouble with the female race? I do not know. But if they bleed, I lose heart also. But when he reads, when he reads, small but deep voiced, he reads well, now weeps, now is cynical, his large horned eyes very black and tearful. And when we visited a poet father, we rode to Jersey on a motor scooter. My tie and tweeds looped in the winds. I choked in the wake of the Holland pipe and cops under glass like carps eyed us. That old father was so mellow and generous, easy to pain, white, open, and at peace, and of good taste, like his Rutherford House. And he read, very loud and regal, 16 new poems based on paintings by Bruegel. The last night out, before I climbed on the formal Capitol Viscount and was shot home high, pure, and clear, seemed like the right time to disappear. Thank you. A new poem. I went to Europe this summer and visited Ireland, my first trip over there. I went to Sligo, where Yeats lived and about which he wrote so many poems, and near Sligo at Drumcliff Churchyard, he's buried in the shadow of Ben Bulben Mountain, which he also had so much to say about. There were a couple of extraordinary things about that gravesite. One was the fact that his wife, who died since he died, is buried with him, and that her name was George. And another is the fact that there's a great phallic prehistoric standing stone standing still in the wall of the churchyard, which has been built around it with the Celtic high cross. Okay. This is for John Unterecker, my colleague at Hawaii, and who taught at the Yates Summer School, which I visited on the occasion of this poem. At Drumcliff Churchyard, County Sligo, that great feather the mind's wind drives over the grave, and which lights and stays on the tomb of Yeats, is made of skin and of thin stone, akin to cliff, akin to drum. On this ancient monastic spot, I feel the shocks of rhythm underfoot. Gigantic hooves of heaving Irish horses, their riders weaving with ecstasy as their long, godlike legs stretch and cleave tight, breaking up the patterning of light, the brown, the black, the roan, the mottled hides give off, like the sun shining and then not, through mist in bursts along Ben Bulben's back. Wild long-haired men and the wild long-haired women ride and merge and are gone. Yeats' grave lifts to heaven the body of a man, the body of a woman, himself, his wife, himself, and his ambiguous epitaph celebrates his birth forever back into life. The great cold eye now opens in the soaring brow of man to woman. So this gravesite is a bridge of sex, and it is a bridge of space between the valley and the mountain, between the long, free flanks of the land and the fossil sea. It is a bridge of time, for the round stone tower still stands where the medieval monks hovered over the church cloths and silver when the swift, marauding Vikings came, and the Celtic rock high cross, figuring how Christian love joins Adam and Eve while Cain's hate kills Abel, is raised along the selfsame wall where a prehistoric standing stone covered with its weathered skin tapers hard toward the moon and sun, its erect substance teeming full of the tiny bright seed of shells. Oh, I can feel the mind's wind blow still over the graves, the church, and Ben Bulbin Hill. Wait, touch your cheek, for this feather's breath breathes too upon you. Now, this is a poem from my brother, which the poet and editor Michael Cudahy, who lives here in Tucson, published in his magazine Ironwood, which, by the way, is one of the best magazines any place. Started with this ring, which is lapis lazuli. I never buy blue things. I always buy brown and red things. And I knew at the time I bought it that there was something going on in me I needed to explore, and that's how the poem happened. Blue is my older brother's color. Wine is brown, you see. So today I bought this ring of gold and lapis lazuli flecked with a bright bronze. His blue is the light hue of his eyes. Brown's the color of our dead mother's long hair, which fell so beautifully about her young shoulders in the picture, and of my own eyes, I can't tell hers. I loved my brother, but never quite knew what to think. For example, he would beat me up as soon as the folks left the house, and I would cry big, loud, feminine tears. He was good at sports and played football, and so instead I was in the marching band. My brother stole rubbers from the store and smoked cigars and pipes, which made me sick. But once we swam together in the Nishnabotna River near home, naked, our blue overalls piled together by the water, their copper buttons like the bronze glints in my ring. I remember once, when I was very young, I looked deep into a pool of blue water. We had no mirror. And I was so amazed, I looked over my shoulder, for I did not imagine it was me caught in that cerulean sky. Thinking it was someone other, I tell you, I confused myself with my brother. Nothing goes with gold, but I can see in this rich blue stone the meeting of our clothes, like the touching of hands when he taught me to hold my fishing pole well and wound up the reel for me. You know, blue is the last of the primary colors to be named. Why, some primitive societies still have no word for it except dark. It's associated with black. In the night, my brother and I would play at games that neither of us could understand. But this is not a confession. It is a question. We've moved apart and don't write, and our children don't even know their own cousin. So I would have you know I want this ring to be an engagement in reconciliation. Blue is the color of the heart. I won't live forever. Is it too late now to be a brother to my brother? Let the golden snake bend round again to touch itself and all at once burst into azure. Thank you. Thank you. I have another prose poem which involves these same colors and the figure of my brother. It's called Prose Poem for My Brother and for My Teacher, Gregory. And it's prefaced with an epigraph from Roberto Assagioli, who was an Italian psychoanalyst who studied with Freud, felt something very deeply missing with Freud and began a new school, which has been called psychosynthesis. This is a quotation from him. We suffer from the repression of the sublime. The first part of the poem describes an extraordinary box, a kind of sculpture with vertical and horizontal wires built into it, harpsichord wires, and at the intersections of these wires were some granite stones. I just feel I should tell people about this box. It was made by a friend of mine who's a sculptor and painter in Seattle named Joseph Goldberg. And I never feel sure that the poem catches the quality of that piece of work. This sculptured open box of mahogany, ivory white inside, is strung both with vertical and horizontal layers of musical wires that sing when struck, and bits of bright granite rock tremble at the intersect. These gems flash in the candlelight, and before me all my beloved childhood looms in the humming levels, each one deeper, older than the other. I tip this artist's box, and my child laughs and moves there in his own time. You will hear me moan. Oh, you will hear me moan with all the sure pleasure of what I thought I'd lost come back again. Why, we have never left our home. On the leather lace fixed about my neck, blue, yellow, red, brown, and black glass African trading beads begin to glow. Their colors all weave and newly flow like translucent and angelic worms together. And beneath these, my neck is as alive with gentle white beads as is a woman's breast. Beside and in the light river, the figures come on stage exactly as they are needed. I tell you, I conduct my own act. A boy poises so youngly, so beautifully, his arms a graceful arrow over his brown head, and he dies. His limbs and body push supple as a whole school of fish. And then his vacant place is taken by another, a man in denim and in boots of red rubber. He is wrenched from the shore and pulled through the fresh busy stream by a kid who tugs on one of his hands and holds a fishing rod. And two, this man is dragged in the opposite direction by a dog on a leash, shaking his wet coat into the stippled light. That man sashayed, he zigzagged this way and that. The man is me. You see, a blue jay does a dance for us. He hops beside a tree that rises inside myself. He half glides, his iridescent blue back striking like a brush of Gauguin on the bare canvas of the air, and then he flies, leaving behind a perfect feather, which I find shades from blue into brown as my brother's color into mine. And now, in the single space the diver and the booted fellow left, my brother and I are there, fishing together, our poles glinting in the water, and my mouth moves, my eyes are alive. I cry to him with joy. That blue jay was a messenger of what I want. My friend, my guide Gregory, on this voyage seems benign. He brushes my chest and my stretched naked arms open to the sun with a branch of fragrant pine. Be healed, he chants with each glancing stroke. Be healed. The needles prick my skin back into life, and I go down to bathe my feet in the stream. The blue veins form a mottled web along my white heel. I can feel my kinship with the pine, the jay, the luminescent stream, and with him. Or is he her, the mother, Gregory, my oracle, my teacher? He leans there in the door of our cabin by the river, his face glowing, hair long and shining as a woman's, his belly fat with life. He is pregnant with the two of us, my brother and I, unborn twins who lie entangled in each other's developing limbs. Soon we will be born. He and I will taste of milk for the very first time, and of strawberry pop, and of bright bananas. And we will eat, my brother and I, a great shining autumn red apple fallen from our father's tree as if from the long sky. And you, too, will taste this apple with us. Let us all embrace, for we all have the same mother, and her name is Grace. Thank you. Wow, this is great, getting applause after poems. Doesn't often happen that way. I've had more applause from singing my German translation of Home on the Range. than I get from most poetry reading. I'll read one more prose poem, then we'll take a break, and when we return after a few minutes toward 10, I'll read the long new poem. This is called Prose Poem Returning Home. It was written on the occasion of my going back to Iowa, where I was born. I published an autobiographical fiction piece called The House That Jack Built, and it was published by Harry Duncan's Press, which was originally the Cummington Press in Vermont, then moved to Iowa, and then to Nebraska. So on the occasion of reading from that book, I went back to my hometown, which is 45 miles away, and this prose poem happened out of that. The argus-eyed old greenhouse is all gone, where once the black banana fronds were. Come from someplace out of town, it seemed like Mars. And the sick, several-colored birds of paradise were there, too, stunning us Red Oak kids visiting from tough old Miss Benware's class. And gone, Kazad's oil station. I peddled there the 5-cent Saturday evening post before dawn, passing like a pale hero through the strong snowstorms, with my cap pulled down around my bitten ears and the skin of my leg too grotesquely breathed on with a black wool sock separated from the knickers. The local cemetery has sprouted much more pine and spruce. It has put on population in the 50 years since I was born. Today, I stand beside my mother's grave in the heavy rain. Did you know it took me decades to find where she was dead? I had imagined there a place for me beside her changing body. But I was wrong. I figured out from the stone placed upon her head like a great foot upon my heart that she was only 28. And now, you see, already it's too late, for the plot is thick, is full. Oh, well. Oh, well, my grandfather took that last spot away from me when I was 3. According to these graves, it was very hard for him, for Otto, his daughter dead, my mother, and his son, my little uncle, had died before when he was only 2 in 1884. Wait, look. My grandfather's wife, Anne, died when his small son did. Well, no, on second look, the same year anyway, I was thinking more of me, for it was I who died and was laid in earth the same day as his daughter. She thought rather that she had given birth in a house on a street named Joy, to a living son named Jack. I want that house. I want that street back. Yet, in some sort of truth or other, it is my mother, Agnes, who has died, and it is I who have stayed alive. Agnes, whose name means lamb. Of sacrifice? Oh, I did not cry. I was quiet as 3 mice. I was dumb before I was wise, and I was drunk before ever I was dead. Last night, I read the handwriting on the wall in the old Westerland Cafe. That at least has stayed. It said, clean the wool out of your zipper, you sheep fucker. I remember here my father downed some beers on Saturday afternoons and listened to the games on the radio. My friend and I had the opera on. Christ, he would say when he came home at 5 o'clock, fuming, is that damn thing still going? And in Iowa, it was. Standpipe, standpipe, I see the standpipe. Whoever truly sang it first won the child's play as we came back to town from rides all over Montgomery County. Now that high monument is gone, as is the circular pavilion near where it was, with the magical name Chautauqua. Red Oak's great cock is now lost to an orange tank on stilts. And the brick house where once I went to school is gone, where Floyd Hicks always won the barefoot race at recess, and that snot-nosed Selma ate the library paste. My home room is gone. Now it's a storage bin for grain. Gone the swimming pool where first I saw Junior O'Dell's new red hair and Marilyn Hughes' breast suddenly bulged beneath her suit. I watched my young seaman float thin cloud palaces of white in an isolated part of the water. And so you see, when I came back to town, I found all my boyhood things and boyhood places gone. Even my grave was robbed. And that is why I saw in the loose driving rain underneath the spruce and pine. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We'll take a little break now. Poem in Progress. I was asked about the title of yesterday. I believe I forgot to mention it, though it started out as a poem in progress with hyphens. When I had finished it, I decided that if I took the hyphens out and there was some notion of progress in the poem, that was exactly what I wanted. So I kept the title Poem in Progress. My publisher is sort of anxious to sell copies of this book, and he asked me to mention that at readings I could pass out little cards which entitle you to $1 off if you send in for the book. It has illustrations by Gary Brown from the University of California at Santa Barbara, and it's nicely done. The poem is in 8 parts. The first part is called First Prelude, Dream in Ohio, The Father. My ship passes over slowly through the foreign lands her lovers all are from. There is not much time. The boat brushes feels the banks of these beautiful canals, but there is no one you will see in the unusual houses with their strange-shaped, attractive red and white suites of dining or brownish, burnished bedroom furniture. Their decorators are inventive and avant-garde, though slightly colorblind. Even if they are empty, nothing's ripped up from the floors, and we can see that there is no thievery. Toward the back of the ship, with its frothing, fountaining wake, I walk Underneath elaborate glass pendant chandeliers, their candle-lit tears turned golden with the muting dust of the last years. Above this old and red San Francisco brocade, I stand at the ship's stern chain. Sure, it's dangerous to be here, drifting all this weird weekend through the landlocked Midwestern town. I think of that possible slip out of the ship's brass fastenings into the long sleep of the wake. But I wave, though. I try to greet as the boat moves on quietly through the avenues some aging men on corners in this alien place. But they only talk among themselves. How can they miss this ship in the streets? These old men miss me trying to salute them. Father, I suppose it's you again. Why did you stop hunting for the vivid pheasants in the fields or having a beer with your friends in the old Westerlin Cafe when I was young in Red Oak, Iowa? Oh, I once thought we might have talked, might try to have something to say. Instead, I ran my buddy's car 90 miles an hour down Highway 48 outside of town and jacked off when I got home. Father, you fucker, I love you still. Still yearn for your advice. Shall I turn back toward the tip of the ship? There is someone alive close by upstairs in this many-tiered boat. I can hear them as the ageless orange moon rises over the small hill or houses. Well, I will go up there to the sailors, perhaps, or the families, or the whores, whoever lives on this ghosted ship that floats through streets where absolutely anything goes and there are no shores. All hill or houses. Well, I will go up there to the sailors, perhaps, or the families, or the whores, whoever lives on this ghosted ship that floats through streets where absolutely anything goes and there are no shores. Part 2. Second prelude, reality in Albuquerque, the sun. Passing through Albuquerque, where I'd read poetry, I find myself beside a quite young drinking buddy. Black-haired and bright-eyed Chicano kid, he wants a Coke with three cherries in it. He gets that, and then asks me, as folks next to each other in bars are apt to talk, why there are no cherries in my glass. Because, I said, knowing I sounded absolutely absurd, screwdrivers just never have cherries with them. Surreal, I thought. What's this kid doing in here at 10 o'clock a.m. anyway? No school today, he says. Teacher's convention. He is only 7, and his father is tending the bar. He asked me where all my kids are. In New York, where I live, I lied. Then told the truth that I was flying back there tonight. And your wife? Third degree, I thought. Well, part of bar talk. Why, New York too, I lied again. How the hell can I tell this kid I hardly ever see my sons because they are 3,000 miles away from me and then some? Perhaps you understand what I mean. But him, both of us in the bar at 10 a.m., he walks to the jukebox with a quarter given by his father, then looks back, admits he cannot read well. So we select together and agree on 2 pieces, playing first that morning song, Bridge Over Troubled Water. Part 3, Plato in Florida, the friend. Our car strays only for today through the Florida highways. Sun-bronzed student named Mike, you are my guide in this incredible place where Cape Kennedy veers to Disney's world. And I feel sure you are a friend. Intense, bushy-haired, your hands scaling from hard work, you've taken on the archaic look of an animal born out of the Orlando swamp. And so you are both old and young, millions of years and 21, balancing between the ancient, ugly, splendid figure of the almost extinct sphenodon, with its median eye quite clear but dull, like the opalescent jewel pendant on a woman's forehead, and the more than human, quite beautiful young man who glows with intelligence from a point somewhere behind the middle of his brow. You've guessed, because I grow older and you have learned from my work, that I may possess some wisdom. Well, right or wrong, still, you ask me to say what I know of Plato. Just wait a while, though, before I say love. Love, Socrates said, is a lack, a sign in the symposium of our poverty. You, with your own love, should I say your own need of music, whether it's the hard or folk rock of your own time, some of it androgynous as David Bowie or Lou Reed, Transformer album, that electric, angelical name, or the classical pieces of mine, would take to heart Bernstein's early serenade he based on Plato with his myth of that interior split. A scholar says, male and female created he it, not them, in Genesis. Then this fable that Plato put to us and Bernstein set of Aristophanes, whose name I think means the shining vision of the best, but my Greek is no longer sure. Bernstein's program notes, like poets' attempts to explain, do not articulate well the sweep of his own sound, where he, in that human or God-given miracle, plays out for us again also the lyrical love song of Agathon for woman, then sings cacophonously Alcibiades' tipsy, horny entry, anxious as he was to put the make on Socrates, his old general from the wars. But the man went home from him at the first bell of dawn, having drunk them all under the table, and afraid still that he would be unable to teach him and us if he touched Alcibiades. Thus he left him unfulfilled as the sky moved from black into light, the love that is a lack. Not that Socrates did not love Alcibiades, but that he did. The other love in Plato's Phaedrus is not thus the need of man for woman, or of man for man, woman for woman. Instead, it is the love that will be felt as fulfillment, the erotic burgeoning of wings whose dry buds become as damp again as the newborn. The wholeness of the trio underneath the charioteer's minding whip, the courageous white horse, and the desiring black. Part 4, Rescue in Florida, the Friend. It was poverty I felt at my reading when we met. I wrapped my legs together, my arms surrounding myself, fetal, vulnerable, and afraid before I had to begin to perform. I felt beside me in the next chair, you with your brown eyes and that lively brush of hair. Felt just the glimmer of your interest and was warmed, though I had never seen you before, except someplace else inside myself. And so I read to you. Your eyes helped the life inside me to unfurl again, like the slow, moist tendrils of a primeval fern. And later, driving with you, I was able to watch with ease, before more dead I could not, the unbelievable shapely peacocks shimmering in the park and road, their graceful crested heads moving in a kind of dance, the albino one isolated as an exile is, his white tail dropped, but still gorgeously, formally curled round like a unicorn's beard. Slow, as a ship does, a car moved through the hens and cocks, blue, brown, red, purple, and with a flashing metallic sculpture sheen among the ungent eucalyptus trees. And there are too many feathered eyes, it seems, reflecting in the Florida water, their elegant baroque fans bursting occasionally in an orgasm which fixes there, weaving in air, a frieze of rockets. Perhaps we can guess peacocks solve the problem of balancing their sex against their heads, or say, their burden against their gift. Part 5, Interlude, the Colombian Statue, Archetype. At the picnic you drove me to in the overfull car, I wanted to speak to you, but you ran off with Bob, your buddy, along the stream. Then there was a lovely interlude with two of your friends, Jay and Kathy, who walked through the green, white, and blue Florida pasture more as a brother and sister than as the lovers they now are. A great fig tree fixed the wandering clouds, the colors, and us there in time. They showed me their childhood river, live water spilling into the many-colored bed of bright rock from three huge tunnels where, when they were kids, they had stripped and slid through one as a furious water moccasin slithered past and the two played that they were already dead. It danced, or dare we say the water moccasin half stepped on their young flesh, light sparkling along it, and slipped through Kathy's very white legs, she said. I thought of Artemis deflecting the sperm of Zeus along her thigh, still virgin. Kathy had no tan then, for it was still the spring. By that light stream, they knew, Jay and Kathy gave me the wood statue of a man from Colombia, a piece both of them loved, and she had hoarded together with the few treasures of the young, because of what they said my poems gave first to them. I remembered at once the story Neruda tells of the source in his early life for his sense of what poetry is, an exchange between strangers. The boy he had never seen beyond the garden wall, who had left a toy white lamb in a niche, and the child Neruda took it, leaving his prize pine cone instead. And the anonymous boy clutched it quick for himself. The Colombian fellow is bearded, benevolent, hatted, a sack like some kind of load at his back, and the jutting folds of his cloak like two low wings. He carries a big bag of gold or of fish in his, say, 50-year-old hands, or he's pregnant with it, with the gift which balances perfectly the weight on his back. The bag's tied up in some cloth that looks knotted in front. His beard parts above the pursed mouth of the sack. The breath he has breathed into it, or it has blown inside him, is given back again. In him, old Colombian, the love of fulfillment he offers us matches exactly at his back, the love of lack. This is part six. Union, father, son, friend, archetype. After the picnic, we all bought books at the flea market. Dostoevsky, Sartre, Camus, The Myth of Sisyphus, that patient man whose burden boulder rolled up again and again, he learned to let become a piece of the given, his shoulder or his gaunt rock cheek. Then, away from the others, we headed for the beach. We were scared away from Daytona, a mere sea of cars, by the seasonal race, the one that's all too human. The next, New Smyrna Beach, whose name suggests wars of heroes brought down to us by Herodotus and the lucid histories of Thucydides. In Smyrna, there burns a small warm aura of figs and of tiresias. That dark, absolutely rich, open place is Plato's full love of landscape, unlike the lack at Daytona. Here the waves moved on shore between hills, gray on black on gray on white, like layers of feeling, of touch, of thought, of insight that we carry around with us, sometimes gentle, sometimes violent, as the violet, pink, and red levels in that vast vagina which holds the ancient sea between its earthen walls, strata of many-shaded sand brought to life inside some goddess's hourglass. It was beautiful but cold in New Smyrna Beach. This somehow brought us together, huddled, holding on to each other against the black hill, my hair gray and yours brown, blue together, mixed with wind, almost invisible in the dark. I felt all the elements with us and all times. The waves rushed in again. Still, you'd made love with your girl, you said, here, this very place, in the warmer New Year. One of the deeper, bright planes of the waves was that one, that generative giving. Friends, father and son, brothers, we clung together, digging our feet deep into the black soil of the sea's hill, burrowing back in the cave, our bodies molded, as if to feel in touch with the earth that binds us all together and keeps us from blowing away in those powerful winds that will fill and shake at us always. At the old man hill with its veins of time like frozen waves upon waves. It was as if we were his own poised burden and gift, the young man born out of the older, or the old from the young, the two of us planted there together beside the loud sea at a hunched hill filmed with the fog, like that dark Colombian man's brown, aged, sculpted legs. And part 7. First reunion in New Orleans, the father as king of revels. In New Orleans, we part with cars. We walk the blocks to Mardi Gras and put on another mask to catch the bright luminescent beads and gold doubloons flung from floats cruising the full streets in endless fabulous parades toward the Gulf. The tractors lugging floats for the crew of great souls wish their way toward the engines of ships because these floats move quite like ships passing in the night. Clown shapes piss behind parades, for thousands are drinking beer in the streets from great white paper cups, or they arc the red and light wine out of goat skins into their mouths. Parades are plays before our own audience. We watch the progress of King Proteus, who changes configurations in the dark like us. There were floats for Zeus, Aphrodite, and for Diane. I think, well, Michael, Here we go again, costumed with painted faces like our 1,000 anonymous friends, levels of beads about our necks, wrists, and the belt loops of our pants. Why, we have so many beads, we heave them back again in an amiable exchange. We shove and shout, we touch and dance in the live New Orleans streets, and the men and women, both old and young, notice us as we them. We are each other's dream within a dream. After the parades and the great cathedral of St. Louis, King of France, oldest in the land, on the same site where its small predecessor was blown apart 250 years ago by the greater King Tornado. After the Cabildo, where our ancient fathers signed in lieu of us for the Louisiana Purchase, we go for New Orleans jazz and hear Sweet Emma singing and still playing a mean piano at age 89, a garter of bells on one leg, red cap, just as she had when jazz was born in Preservation Hall, well named, just off Bourbon Street, with its black lace of delicate worked iron balconies and the old absinthe house where King Faulkner met and sipped double shots of Jack Daniels with his friend, Elder King Sherwood Anderson. On Fat Tuesday night, as the rebels moved to their height, we leave and drive in the truck of a guy we had met through the strange, moonlighted Louisiana landscape I had never seen by day, toward his sculptor's kiln, 12 miles out. Trees drop their gentle debris of moss on us. We stop only once to pick and give each other the newly blooming, reaching azalea flowers which seem to glow under the moon all in the same color, although we know each fresh pale cluster, like a feather plucked from a peacock's tail, is radiantly different. This seems an oracle of what we find just ahead, a huge monolithic concrete kiln glowing quiet as the moon itself, all filled up with white-hot, lustrous ghosts of earth our friend had made. We are not amazed to find they've reached their peak of heat alone in the middle of a blue field as Mardi Gras hits frenzy and consumed, burned up, everything falls away from us under the white moon like revelers' masks and costumes, leaving us stark naked there as for making love or art. And finally, part 8. Second reunion in San Francisco, The Lost Son. When you visit San Francisco, it's my turn to drive. White old Corvair, not your new car. Mine, like a galley, even has gills, outlets for oars, manned by machine slaves through these chiaroscuro streets. My pistons poke and halt and fart, show us both their need for a rest. I remember the last time I saw you in your car, a red contemporary sculpture in Florida, you living, laughing in the front as if to balance its trunk lid open, extending a makeshift coffin, your own hollow coffee table, which you plan to climb in and out of again in an experimental movie your friend would make at school. We drive now for your welcoming drink at the Cliff House, which is so absurdly painted a false water blue, sailboat white with comic book clouds, to make us guess, gliding down streets, that we'll soon hit the sea, as we would, since it's right there where it has always been. When I was just married a generation ago, well, a whole life hence, my wife and I had salmon steak in this place. Now the saws whine to make it new again. This house has burnt and been built and burnt and built three times. We gaze out of the corner window just over the sea, there where the sun simply all of a sudden descends in its golden red Apollonian last moments, as in its first, illuminating the foam from which Aphrodite sprang. This ocean turns, sweeps, not as on the beach at New Smyrna, where it was dark, or as unseeing Homer knew of the old world, Smyrna, quite black. He sat by the mythic river which runs through the Melos Valley near Diana's baths, Diana, the virgin helper at difficult births, patroness of crossways. Over us in Sutro Park, her statue waits, its bow arm broke like a flawed crescent of her ancient moon. And below us at the Cliff House, the spread mud landscape of ruins of the elaborate glass pavilion, the Sutro Baths, given to San Francisco by a man wealthy but guilty for the deaths of coolies who built his railroad shafts through the California rock. Super May Day Festival at Sutro Baths, April 30th, 1898, commencing at 10 in the morning, lasting all day. Lots of fun for the little folks, a beautiful queen and triple maypoles, gorgeous butterfly ballet, 1,000 kids in grand march and fancy dances, catch true color and detail in giant camera. We've seen in souvenir shops the flat old sepia photographs of those now burnt baths. All men, it seems, though they were not, bathing suits clean up to their shoulders, and no mothers around, brothers of Athene, who was born from the bones and labyrinths of her father's brain. With their arms crossed, they pose arrogant as hunters or lynchers whose pictures I remember as a kid. Diana turned huntsmen into stags and let them be torn apart by their own hounds if they smiled at her. Smyrna colonists, the encyclopedia says, were from Lesbos, we remember. But let's both just fuck all this and have our drink. Look out at the kids poling on that rock, famous for years, though the young fishers surely don't care, joined by a pier of sorts to shore, with the waves so white, furious this dangerous day, We know it's cold for them. We shiver, sipping our champagne, which froths like the foam outside. As we watch the play, our talk wanders easy, happy, even if we are a bit chilly. Christ! A kid slips quickly off the rough rock in front of our very eyes. We gulp another drink. We blink, listening to seals about the rock increase their bark over shocked silence inside us, and catching out of the corners of our eyes the gulls rising up, wings flash white on gray. Suddenly, I realize you and I, as we sip cocktails, do not watch the topless and predictable entertainment of the big town, but we are seeing a boy drown. I put my civilized drink down and run through the tourist-crammed bar to the telephone. A friend of the boy's is running up along the shore. Soon, wails of police cars. Firemen stand around in their weird black pants, not well suited for finding the drowned, but hustling still for death, or for the human hopeful giving of breath, waiting to be shown to the sight. Some watchers swing coin binoculars out to the point. Old signs in the sand say, "Fun for everybody here." Pay dimes to see somebody drown. Some people still able to manage their martinis. We stare at the stark old rock from the wood rail outside. There are no Florida peacocks here, odd as they are. No iridescent Iowa pheasants. Giddy seagulls jabber around, and the sandpipers pick their way. Well, we are all voyeurs, vultures round the boy who cannot be found, death rising cold in his groin from the thrust of the sea that once gave all of us our birth. This kid gives up his life in breath, which surfaces white someplace by that rock a little while, long enough for me to feel your turmoil churning in myself. The Coast Guard's sharp chopper struggles overhead, hovering above this sunset-lit stage before our strange audience. A fake boat out of the dream rivers of Ohio, a ship from the beaches near Orlando, and with a lurid hued hint of your own red car. It whirs impotently, spider-like parody of God, which has split the shot with color webs of air and of human breath. Jealous Minerva, useless Deus ex machina. But the drama we are all of us caught up in has let you stay alive here beside me in a blue coat, Michael. For you have not slipped with this 6 or 7 year old kid off the treacherous Frisco cliff as we did our best to have a happy reunion drink, not funereal sips out of that mixed chalice all of us know. Perhaps it is your life, or yours, or yours, or yours, that I felt upstairs in those luminous and dark hidden levels of my own still quite navigable ship. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.